Welcome to the City Club of Eugene's July 21st, 2017 program. Travelers in Eugene, problem or only another lifestyle? This is the 39th program in our current programming year. I'm Sandra Bishop, City Club President. Support for the City Club is provided by our members and sponsors, including Housing and Community Services Agency, HCSAW. HCSAW is committed to providing safe, affordable, and energy-efficient housing for low-income families, elderly citizens, and persons with disabilities. The coordinator of today's program is Sandy Erickson. Today's speakers will be introduced by Sandy.
Welcome. Today, the internet, slow growth, telecommuting, new disrupting industries, and fewer traditional nuclear families all contribute to new lifestyles. In the past, life changes were prompted by depressions, war, seasonal working conditions, just to name a few factors. Regardless of the cause, the effect then and now was to grow the ranks of a transient population, especially in cities bisected by railroads or major highways. Here in Eugene, with both factors, there is a growing realization that the unhoused population is actually composed of subcultures that may be quite different from each other. Therefore, they need to be addressed as differently by city services and local residents and businesses. Today's program will explore the topic of who is traveling through and how they may be a different population from the more typically described residential homeless, and how those differences influence local assistance programs. Speakers include two very effective leaders who work directly with the traveling population, helping to solve local issues. David Gerber, our first speaker, completed his master's degree in planning, public policy, and management at UO in 2009. He has been the executive director of the homeless outreach team since 2012. But surprise, David spent 12 years on the streets. Before starting a roofing business, becoming a single dad, and returning to college. He is the editor and publisher of the Vagabond Street newspaper and runs a weekly community building chess program in Kesey Square known as Slow Motion Sundays. Our second speaker, Ben Brubaker, has been a crisis worker at Whiteberg Clinic in Eugene for over 10 years, where he is now the administrative coordinator. He has filled many roles there, including grant writer, teacher, counselor on the 24-hour hotline, and member of the mobile team CAHOOTS, dispatched through the Eugene Fire Police Ambulance Communications Center. Before Whitebird, Ben was a member of the 24-hour security team for 9 months at Hurricane Katrina's relief kitchen camp, and for 4 years a counselor at the lockdown residential treatment facility for teen boys. These people know what they're talking about. Our first questioner is Aria Seligman, and she's a member of the City of Eugene Human Rights Commission and co-chair of the Human Rights Commission's Homelessness Working Group. She works as a public affairs specialist for the state of Oregon. So welcome, and David, you're on.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, everybody. It's exciting to be here. I appreciate the wonderful introduction.
Aaron, it's a really live mic.
Oh, okay. I just want to make sure everyone can hear me. All righty, well, great. Let me get started then. Thank you for the City Club for inviting me, and I liked the introduction. It was actually pretty good. I was going to go over some of that real briefly, just to let you know a little bit about myself. Let's see. When I was 28 years old, I had my own roofing business in Illinois. Then I became a single dad and went back to college and eventually got my master's degree here at the U of O. But before that, I was a traveler who traveled for about a dozen years around the United States, I had an adventurous spirit. I left home and ended up doing a lot of fruit picking. I went coast to coast with the fruit tramps for a while, and it became a construction worker. So I want people to know that I speak from the heart, and I'm here today to talk to you as the director of the homeless outreach team about the topic of travelers. I earned my master's degree in public policy and planning from the U of O in 2009, and it's really important to express to you that my goal is public service. And I really think that all of us here, whether or not we agree on all of the issues, should remember that we do share common ground, and a lot of us have the same goals in our heart. And I hope we can move together to making progress on these important issues. So, my experience here in Eugene, Oregon, coming out of the University of Oregon, I started the Oregon Vagabond Street newspaper, and I learned a great deal from that experience. We provided a weekly structure for people under the bridge in Washington Jefferson Park and put together a writing workshop, which turned out to be a really wonderful exercise, more than I ever expected, in that people were putting down their ideas on paper and just coming in weekly with their thoughts together. And we saw lots of folks making progress with their lives. We also were putting that into a product which was for sale. And we, as they do in many other cities around the country, it's been successful in Seattle, and Portland has a street newspaper. So we worked on that for a while, and we'd like to bring it back in print. We went temporarily out of print for a number of reasons. And if we do bring it back, we're going to have a more structured approach to it so that we can be more effective in helping people transition from experiencing homelessness back into a structured life. Okay, well, let me see. So the program evolved from the street newspaper. As it began to struggle, I created the homeless outreach team. In an effort to bring local businesses on board, we started a public service, or it became a public education campaign, which has now evolved into an outreach program. Our message was clearly to support local service providers. And that would be the best way that you could make a difference if you wanted to donate some money towards the effort of homelessness. Okay, so I'm going to go out on a limb here just a little bit and attempt to put together some categories for travelers. And again, I don't mean to be controversial by doing this, but I'm hoping it'll be helpful, give people something to think about. And before I even start, I did leave out a category for mentally disabled people. I was going to have six categories and include mentally disabled. And when I really thought this through, I feel myself, at least, that people with mental disabilities are probably distributed amongst the other five categories. And I'll also preempt this by saying that when I was a street kid back in the 80s, this is when the Reagan administration was mainstreaming a lot of people out of mental institutions. So I was a teenager in Florida and all around California, you name it, and I did meet a lot of people who were collecting what is known as a nut check. This is a term people may or may not be familiar with, but there are people out there that, back in the 80s at least, would apply for what they called a nut check. You had to serve time in an institution, and you were then pronounced disabled, but the idea was that you could collect it wherever you were. And so I met people that were living outdoors collecting these checks at post office boxes, wherever they were able to establish a residence, I suppose. Okay, so here we go. I'm probably running short on time. I want to give you guys these categories. The first category of travelers, in my opinion, would be one known as the trust fund kids. These are often adventurers and runaways, young people. Then we have another group of older folks, which can be referred to as remittance men. And they often follow the path of least resistance. And these folks are the type of individuals who might qualify for housing first, and that they're chronically homeless. And I learned about this when I was doing the street newspaper, that some of these guys actually have family members who will send them money not to come home. And I thought that this was pretty hard to believe, you know, but it's true. So these are essentially people who have, I'm assuming they've burned their bridges, and they're not welcome back home. So they come out here. And anyway, so let's move forward. We have time-honored tradition of street performers, and this is folks known as buskers. And when I was on the streets, the street musicians were the ones that watched out for the street kids. So I have a great respect for buskers, and I think that they have a place in our community. And we can speak to that more if you have some questions about that. Then we have the fourth group then would be your outlaws, which would include your people who are essentially exiles, pedophiles. Again, I'm not going to generalize, but I'm just trying to be helpful. So the outlaws are people who are living outside the law, and there may be parasitic people, pedophiles, drug addicts, and exiles of all types. And they blend in with the other travelers. And then we have another group, which I think is often overlooked, which are the intergenerational homeless people. These are kids whose parents are in prison, who've grown up in families wrought with addiction. They've often run away from dangerous situations, and I really think that we need to do more to look out for the young people coming out of foster care. The kids who grow up in foster care really suffer a lack of support more than anything I've ever seen, and it tears my heart out to worry about them because they don't have anyone to return home to like I did when I finally decided to get off the streets. So our outreach program has evolved from a public education campaign into an outreach program, and this year we have partnered with the city of Eugene and begun a Sunday chess program in Kesey Square. We call it Slow Motion Sundays. Everybody's welcome. We want tourists to come there, any walk of life, all skill levels, and it's been really nice. We have our outreach program cards. We welcome everybody to Eugene. We offer to help them to assess their situation. And we're also creating some level of expectation, and I call it an expectation of civility. And that really what we're doing is just asking people to slow down, take a deep breath. You can learn a lot through the game of chess, actually. You can learn to plan ahead and not to give up and to assess your situation. So I don't know if they're waving at me if I'm running out of time. I have a couple more notes. But essentially what we're really, my organization is geared more at an upstream approach to people on the street. We see homeless people as an indicator sign of much deeper social ills, similar to a dead minnow floating on a pond. We don't know what killed the minnow. The point source pollution may be far away and hard to identify, but we sure don't blame that minnow. But we see that minnow is telling us something's wrong, something more than just what's on the surface is happening. So the upstream approach, in addition to what's being done, because I truly believe that if charities could have solved this problem by now, they would have. We need to do even more than what we're doing. And I think I can let it go at that. I'll be happy to answer your questions, and I'm excited to get involved with the question and answer process. Thank you very much.
Thank you, David. I really appreciated that, and I appreciate this opportunity to be here. Again, my name is Ben Brubaker. I am one of the administrative coordinators at Whitebird Clinic, as well as a crisis worker on the CAHOOTS Mobile Crisis Intervention Team. Just to give a little bit of background from where I'm coming from, I know many of you are familiar with Whitebird services, but we offer a whole variety of services to folks who are low income, no income, potentially homeless, possibly suffering from substance abuse issues and or mental health issues. That includes crisis intervention, both mobile and in-house, as well as some case management. We also do outpatient drug and alcohol treatment, have medical and dental programs. And we also help people with benefits assistance. So a whole kind of wide variety of supports that we offer and are very familiar with this population and have been going strong for about 45 years now. So it's kind of been an honor for me to work at Whitebird over the last decade and be able to build on some of that really strong foundation of some of the local activists that originally started Whitebird as an all-volunteer grassroots effort, and to be able to be one of the people helping shepherd it now that it's grown into kind of one of the mainstream institutions here in town trying to support folks. So the travelers topic is interesting to me, and I just, you know, I've definitely had a lot of face-to-face work with folks that are experiencing homelessness in our area. it's really difficult for me to be able to separate out all the different categories of folks that because there is so much overlap between all of those populations. And when you start trying to look at who's a traveler and who's not, it becomes even more gray. Is somebody who grew up here and then left for 5 years and then came back a traveler? You know, how many of us in this room are actually from Oregon? You know, and does that make us travelers then because we've only been here 10 years? That's all the time I've been here. You know, so it becomes really difficult to separate out all those. I definitely think that a lot of the categories that David pointed out are there, but there's just so much of that diversity among those individual populations that it becomes really difficult to figure out who is who. You know, we can look at statistics across the nation and know that the homelessness crisis is increasing across the nation. We've seen decreases if you look at certain studies like those that are put out by HUD, but you have to start questioning how effective are one-night counts to really determining a population. And they've changed the way they've counted in the last 5 or 6 years and how those homeless one-night counts work, and we immediately saw declines in the population, which is great for the federal government and other agencies to pat themselves on the back to say that the issue is being solved, but it all becomes a really statistical game to me. So we know that last year there were record highs for the number of students in our schools that were reported having experienced homelessness in the last year. You know, we know that that was a record high for the state, and I trust that count than a lot of other homeless one-night counts to give us an indicator of what we're still facing. And if you follow media across the nation, as I do, we're seeing more and more municipalities, you know, working with these issues around homelessness. And with that means that people are going to be moving from city to city at times looking for resources and looking for new opportunities. You know, and this is a pattern that we're familiar with. If you go all the way back to the Grapes of Wrath and how that, you know, the post-Depression, Depression era homeless camps that were set up across the nation, I think we're experiencing that again as a country. You know, the difference is you can't just set up a shanty town anymore. And the government is not doing large-scale housing camp efforts the way they were, and as you can read about in the Grapes of Wrath, we're not making those efforts. The National Civilian Conservation Corps was, I think, a beautiful effort that was made to try to support people during that time, and we're not seeing the amount of resource that was put into that to help with our, you know, fix both our public infrastructure as well as to be able to employ people and get people back to work. We're not seeing those kinds of efforts. What we are seeing a lot of is NIMBYism. We're seeing a lot of folks being moved from street corner or city to city, you know, and not a lot of individuals and individual cities stepping up and saying enough, we need to support the people that are here. And I agree with the upstream efforts and the need for those kinds of how do we help people avoid homelessness and avoid those kinds of things, but I also know that you cannot maintain and or regain stability if you don't have shelter. You know, if you're not able to get people into any kind of shelter, then their ability to be able to track and better themselves, it becomes a real low probability. And if anything, we know that the rest stop program locally is working. We know that Nightingale and community supported shelters and others are having awesome success, and yet they're struggling to open up new sites. You know, that we as a city, we as a county are still not giving people a place to go. We have a lot of conversation around who we should help, how we should help them, and where they should be, which is usually just not here. But we very rarely are actually telling people, where can you be? Where can you go? You know, to bring it just closer to home, at Whitebird, we frequently have folks that will hang around our building, and we'll work with them, try to get them to not be there, work with neighbors, work with local law enforcement. But the time period that we saw the most dramatic decrease in the number of people hanging around the blocks around where our building is, where our day access center is, was when the Sleeps Camp was existing on Franklin, where they had the protest group had taken over a parking lot and made it a small little camp and had volunteers that were helping to keep it safe and had porta potties there. And suddenly we did not see the numbers of people hanging out outside of our building or in our neighborhood, because they had a place to be. They had a low barrier shelter option. They could go there and drink their beer or sit there and chat with people or hang out there or whatever the thing that they had going on. And they weren't impacting the social service network. They weren't impacting the law enforcement network as much. They weren't impacting the local hospitals and EDs simply because they had a place to be. You know, and I think as we look at this issue with travelers, I think that I get a little uncomfortable with the way that we use the language and labels around transient and traveler, because again, it starts to sound to me like it becomes a qualifier for who is deserving of help. And my experience on Cahoots and Crisis, when I have a person in front of me that is cold in the middle of the night or in some kind of emotional crisis, I'm not asking for their demographic information. I don't think it's appropriate. I think that starts to lead to, well, okay, you've only been here 6 months. Sorry, I can't help you. You know, these are conversations I would never have. And I learn their stories. I know why they're there. You know, and while there are populations that I believe are, you know, have support families or trust funds and are enjoying the traveling lifestyle, a lot of those people are really self-sufficient. They live out of dumpsters because they want to live out of dumpsters. We thwart them with locks on dumpsters and keep them from being able to help themselves to the wasted food that's there. But, you know, there is that group of travelers that is self-sufficient in some way, but there's a lot of folks that aren't. They're escaping abuse. They have mental health issues or substance abuse issues. You know, there are folks that fell on hard times and haven't been able to get their feet on the ground again. And I think that that's why it hits really close to home for me, because I've heard hundreds, if not thousands, of people's stories over my time at Whitebird, and I know what the pattern is. I know that that there is a lot of upstream, you know, factors that befall people that cause and result in homelessness and other kinds of issues associated with it. You know, additionally, I think the last thing I just want to say on the labels piece is I really believe that populations who are experiencing homelessness or who have mental health or substance abuse issues, that those groups are some of the last groups that bigotry against them is socially acceptable. If you look at mainstream media and the kinds of letters to the editor, the kinds of posts on Facebook, even on the mainstream media sites, you know, if somebody got on there and dropped the N-bomb or some kind of racial slur, they would immediately pull that comment as hate speech. I have begged local media outlets to pull trash, scum, filthy addict. I've begged them to pull those comments down, and they will not. They do not see that as hate speech. And I think that at its base level, we're not going to be able to solve the issues around homelessness that we have in this community or in this country until we really start addressing that with more upstream education for the general populace about the human beings that are behind those labels. And I think that, you know, finally, just to kind of focus a little bit more on solutions, I think we're making great strides. I think the rest stops, things like that, are the right step. We need more of them. You know, we need more day access centers so that people can get on computers, get on phones, start rectifying and getting their lives together and trying to move up and step up and back out of homelessness. We need more low barrier shelters. You know, we have high barrier shelters, shelters that you have to mind your P's and Q's, be completely clean and sober, all of those kinds of things. But we know a huge portion of the population of folks that are homeless are struggling with mental health and or co-occurring substance use disorders. So high barrier shelters are automatically excluding a huge number of people that are homeless. You know, so we need more low barrier shelters. We need storage areas. We need more rest stops. We probably need more sobering and detox capacity. There are two beds if you're a female in Eugene or Springfield that's intoxicated in the middle of the night. There are two beds for you. Or we take you to the hospital and the hospital's never happy to see you. You know, so there's definitely a need for like more like sobering detox facilities to help get people clean and sober and, or at least keep them safe while they're sobering. We need more low-income affordable housing. We saw the trickle-down effect of as people, as rents have gone up and things like that locally. We know that that's pricing more and more people out of our local housing market, resulting in more people ending up sleeping in their vehicles and cars. You know, in Oregon, they noted that there's about 60% of the homeless population that they think is unsheltered, which is one of the highest levels in the nation, because we don't have shelter resources. And for school-age families and kids, It's like that 60% of those children reporting being homeless said they were sleeping in a car, you know, or a tent somewhere. And additionally, I think that banning the box, which is what some people are calling the idea that we need to get rid of, have you had a felony conviction, at least for a local state government positions, that they're starting to actually take that off and make that not a criteria. It's still a criteria for most housing options and most job options for folks. And so anybody that has any kind of criminal background, any kind of involvement in the justice system in the past is potentially automatically not allowed to get a job and start over. And we're in a digital age now where we have long memories and people can track things like that forever. And there are folks that cannot get housing and or jobs simply because of the history of some kind of crime, even if it was 10, 20 years ago now. And then finally, again, just the housing first, shelter first models have been proven to work. The science is there. The studies are there. And yet we still are dragging our feet on implementing those models. And what we're doing is wasting a lot of money and resource and causing a lot more human suffering because we're not following that science and that those studies that have shown that those models work. That's what's going to help rectify some of the issues with homelessness in a cost-effective way. So thank you very much for your time, and thank you to those who helped set this up and make it happen.
All right, thank you very much. That was quite an eye-opening presentation. I want to ask our guests to get settled up front. And remember, the microphone's really live, so you can be quite a ways away from it. It'll pick it up. So I'd like to introduce our first questioner today, Arya Seligman. Arya Seligman is a member of the City of Eugene Human Rights Commission, and she's also co-chair of the Homelessness Working Group of the Human Rights Commission. She works as a public affairs specialist for the state of Oregon. So, Arya, either here or at the other mic, be great.
Okay. Thank you, City Club, for inviting me to have the honor of asking the first question. And thanks especially to the members of the Homelessness Working Group who've been so supportive as I've come on board. Thank you. So the other day, I was down at Farmer's Market, and a homeless vet asked me for spare change. He was unable to walk, sitting in a wheelchair, and he showed me his ID from the VA. After my interaction with him, a man who was walking behind me scoffed. He said he doubted the man's identity. I told him that I believed him, and I choose to assume good intentions. The man then told me that that was the problem. People like me were the reason so many homeless people were coming to Eugene. At first, I was horrified and somewhat angry at his accusation, but I collected myself and said, "Sir, there but for the grace of God go you." He shouted, "No, you're wrong. There is no God." I smiled and I said, "God bless you." Now, I know that you don't have to believe in God or any particular thing in order to have compassion for the needy. Certainly, no one would choose to be homeless and in need, like the veteran I spoke with that day, or the many other unhoused Eugenians we are charged with looking out for. We know that a community's resilience is measured by how it treats its poor, and we know we have much work to do in terms of providing adequate shelter and services, as well as decriminalizing acts that are not merely human rights, but human needs, such as sleeping. Against this backdrop of suffering in our city, which is besieged by economic disparity, we have many travelers who come to Eugene in summer to temporarily stay, and that has been the case for the 26 summers that I've lived here and many more. The right to travel is protected under the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and as a civil right under the U.S. Constitution. In addition, panhandling is constitutionally protected as free speech under the First Amendment. Of course, City policies must always be based upon respect for human rights and constitutional freedoms. Yet we know that discrimination is typical in the lives of people who are unhoused, and it spreads to people who are passing through as well. My question is, how have you seen discrimination manifest among the clients you serve and the travelers, and what should our community do to make everyone feel welcome?
Gosh, that is a thought-provoking question for sure. We see discrimination every single day, and a lot of us discriminate whether we know it or not. It's really something that's been taught to us, too. And I say we're not born with discrimination, but we are taught that by our society and by our parents. So when I see discrimination manifested in the clients I'm serving, you know, I'm trying to really think of the best way to think about this. I do know what we can do to make everybody feel welcome. So, discrimination, gosh. I think that as far as discrimination goes, I'll just give you my opinion. I think that people discriminate against others because they need to do so to make themselves feel bigger. When you put somebody down, it's to make yourself feel better. So when I see people discriminating against others, a lot of times it's also sort of a group think mentality too. It's like I'd rather pick on them rather than having them all pick on me. So a lot of people follow the leader. That's where I think I really do see that discrimination manifesting amongst people on the street. Although I can't give any specific examples, it's not just something I see that much. I don't know. I think that discrimination is also in the eyes of the beholder because people discriminate against themselves. And they indiscriminately discriminate, whether they mean harm by it or not. It can be taken seriously or not. So, I tell you what, though, you're getting me thinking about this. And when I was on the road, when we were street hustlers, okay, we were essentially recruited to deal drugs and into prostitution and things like that. As soon as we hit town, when I used to go to San Diego and first day in town, how you guys doing? Do you need something to do? Do you want to hold some drugs? Do you want to line us up with this and that? So we were recruited to work, and we were able to do that, and we took pride in the fact that we were hustlers and that we weren't, there was an underclass beneath us that was the alcoholic drunks, and we never fell into that group. We used to laugh at them, and we were better than them because I don't want to go out on a limb with this, but I do see that stratification amongst people almost in any situation. So, moving on, I don't really know what we can gain from that insight, but discrimination is something that we should try to rise above. And how can we make people feel welcome? Well, of course we can treat everybody with a handshake and a look in the eye, and the problem with that these days is if you look them in the eye and smile, they want to shake you down. So I see a lot of people with their cell phones. They walk through town. They don't look at each other. If you're an outgoing, friendly person like me, hi, how are you? Hey, can I talk to you for a minute? I need some help. And it's like, well, don't you know about all the services and stuff? And, well, okay, leave me alone then. So we can definitely welcome everyone to town. I do that every Sunday with my information cards. And I'll just mention one more thing that I think one of the keys to happiness, there are four keys to happiness. I call this my first Monday doctrine. When I was a traveler, we were welcome into town. You could party all weekend long, but there was an expectation that on Monday morning, you get up and go look for something to do. Okay, so the keys to happiness, faith, family, community, and work. Everyone has some sort of talent they can contribute. And on the first Monday, not on Friday because it's payday, but on Monday, you should go out and try to find something for yourself to do. Employment would be ideal, but maybe you can participate in any sort of activity that's positive. And again, I think this is a new idea. It's called the First Monday Doctrine. And it comes from the idea that we all live on a farm and we all do our share. And you feel a lot better when you pitch in. And I guess to just finish that up, kind of long-winded here, but three consecutive Mondays and no success, you might be in the wrong spot. I mean, how many Mondays can you keep trying? Thank you.
Thank you. That was David Gerber.
Okay.
Ben Brubaker.
So, you know, I've seen discrimination, I think, a couple different ways. I definitely have seen the kind of discrimination that you're talking about, where there is somebody kind of that's maybe housed and trying to put somebody into a box where they feel like they can then shift any kind of responsibility or feel like that, you know, that's not my fault. I have nothing to do with that. That's their fault. And I've definitely seen that kind of discrimination. We've seen the high level of discrimination of homeless people being attacked by those that are housed. And if you actually look statistically, a lot of violence runs more that direction than folks that are homeless attacking folks that are housed. I've seen people egged for moving cars that were homeless, which leaves nasty bruises. I've seen people who have had their sleeping bags caught on fire around them. That's happened a couple times in the last 3 or 4 years. So I've definitely seen like that really high level of discrimination, and even some of the lower levels that I talked about earlier with some of the social media stuff that I kind of watch happen a lot. On the other part of your question, then, what should we do in our community to make everyone feel welcome? My hope is to have more downtown day access kinds of centers that could be information referral, but also might bleed over into tourism and being able to also just help be an orientation center. At one point, there's actually a little kiosk out back of Whitebird, a little small tiny yurt that used to be setting on Kesey Square and actually was an information and referral hub on Kesey Square. And it was both for human services locally and was kind of something that our INR program actually eventually developed out of in the help book that we sell and stuff. But that service was also for whoever was down there and helping anybody find anything, whatever resource they were looking for. If they were, you know, new to town and just looking for what stores to go to, whatever, they would do all that. And my hope is we can maybe create some more kind of community center feeling things, so it's not just a day access center that is only for those that are homeless, but more of like, how can we have a public restroom that includes an information kiosk, for instance? You know, I think that there's really cool ideas like that we could come up with that could help people feel more welcoming and also help direct people towards appropriate resources.
Great, thank you very much. That was Ben Brubaker. And so we're going to take a break now for about 5 minutes to formulate questions from each table, and then we'll return with audience questions. So once the table comes up with a question, then someone can line up in the chairs over here. And remember, after you've asked your question, please return to your seat at your table. Our camera is back in the corner, and we're getting nothing but profiles if you keep the speakers focused over into the corner here. So just ask your question and move back to the table. That would be great. And remember, only City Club members are allowed to ask questions at the microphone. So we'll be back in about 5 minutes. Thank you.
This is KLCC Eugene 89.7, KLCO Newport 90.5, 89.1 KLFR Reedsport, and at 88.1 KLFO Florence, KMPQ Roseburg, KLBR Bend. KLCC is a service of Lane Community College. We're on Facebook and Twitter and online at klcc.org.
Welcome back to the July 21st City Club program, Travelers in Eugene, Problem or Only Another Lifestyle? Support for the City Club is from members and sponsors, including Hearing Associates, who offer a full range of diagnostic and preventative health care hearing professional services, and KLCC 89.7 Radio NPR for Oregonians. And now to member questions. Please go ahead, Betty.
Thank you. Betty Taylor, City Club member since 1990, one of the few left, and City Councilor since 97. My question is, do you think the former LCC building downtown would make a good homeless shelter with places for people to sleep and a gathering place on the main floor? Thank you.
I can answer that fairly quickly. Betty, yes. So again, Ben Brubaker with Whitebird Clinic. We believe any kind of shelter / day access center downtown, it would be a huge step forward and probably 30 years in the making in Eugene. So We really are hoping that something like that will happen. And if not that building, some other building located kind of centrally like that would be wonderful. And we've actually been doing some brainstorming at Whitebird about ways that we might be able to assist and or plug into those kinds of efforts. So I really would love to see something like that happen with that building or other similar properties.
Great, thank you. Next question.
A similar, Hank Elder, Dr. Hank Elder, I'm a member for 2 years. A similar question, though, is what other housing options and what obstacles are there to developing other options? What can we do about it?
Which part of that three-part question is more important?
What can we do to provide better opportunities for housing for homeless?
Perfect.
Thank you. David Gerber with the Homeless Outreach Team. You know, my path when I was traveling was living in a vehicle. And I know that's not realistic for everyone. Yet, first of all, you have to have a driver's license. But it's nice to have a vehicle, inexpensive vehicle. It's a place you can lock up your belongings. It gives you transportation to get to work every day. You're able to then make it out to the grocery store where you can get your food less expensively, and you can find rent on the outskirts of town. So I think transportation in a low-cost vehicle, I think, is something that we really should think about. And then something that we could do along those lines would be campgrounds, where you could pull in for $5 or $10 a night and plug in, take a shower, and have your vehicle there and a tent. That'd be great. That's what worked for me.
That's great. Thank you. Go ahead.
Jerry Smith, City Club member. I'm a retired social worker, and I face hundreds of homeless people a week. And what I want to say is, there's responsibility for taking care of Americans who are abandoned and disabled. And as best I can tell, it's at the federal and state level. Are the federal and state people doing enough here in Eugene?
You know, it's tough for me because I do believe that there is some responsibility at both the federal and state level. I think there's also some responsibility locally, even within our own county city. And I think that through all those chains, I don't know that enough is being done. And I think what we're doing instead is throwing money at issues that could be solved in much more efficient and much more low-cost ways. But not everybody plays chess. The ability to have foresight is something that currently I don't think we have a lot of in our culture. The ability to think 3 or 4 moves ahead, convincing people to spend money now so that you can save money down the road. And again, that's back to the housing first and seeing how a lot of those things work. You have to put money up front, but you have a bunch of people push back against it immediately. But even when you explain, well, you're going to throw money at it instead through law enforcement, hospitalization, all these other things, you still have these people that will push back against it. The other thing I will say that will not make me popular in the state of Oregon probably is sales tax. All these other states do it. We've got to find a way to do some kind of sales tax, even if it's on more luxury items, something. It's a funding stream that we were able to avoid because of the logging and because of the, those kinds of incentives that we had for a while with some of from the federal government that we don't have now. We need some other kind of revenue streams in this state. And I know that doesn't make me popular, but it's true.
Go right ahead.
David, sure. With the outreach team, just quickly add to that. What I've learned through my research, this is not my area of expertise, but there are often a lot of resources being spent to keep people from ever becoming homeless. So once you fall into homelessness, it's a different situation, but oftentimes it may seem inefficient, like a lot of the federal money may be going to people to keep them from ever actually becoming homeless in the first place.
Okay, thank you. Go ahead.
Susan Conley, City Club member since 2008. Our program today is supposed to be on travelers, and so I'm very disappointed that we have 3 homeless advocates here, and we do not have anyone representing the citizens that live downtown, the businesses that are downtown, and other people who deal with it, such as the people who clean up the mess every single morning downtown. So I would urge that the speakers, even though they're homeless advocates, talk a little bit about travelers, because so far we've just heard about homelessness, which we've already had several programs on homelessness. So along the line of asking about travelers, our table's question was, if we build it, will they come?
Yes, I believe that if we want to stop with the kinds of issues that are generated downtown by whatever subgroups of homeless individuals that we want to try to identify, we have to give them a place to be. The issue that I face on Cahoots every single night when I am trying to deal with those issues and prevent those, some of those messes and things like that, I'm really familiar. I try to even clean up the messes that I find when I'm out on the job and stuff like that. The issue I have is, where do I tell somebody to go? Because otherwise we're moving them from neighborhood to neighborhood. Washington Jefferson Park now is a hotbed right now with a lot of folks living in it, basically, because of a larger push to move people out of downtown. We have spent 30 years in this city moving people from location to location to location, neighborhood to neighborhood, and not having a here is where you can be. If I had that resource on Cahoots, I could prevent more of those messes and more of those issues that you're describing downtown for the traveler groups that are actually just passing through, as well as the people that live here on the streets.
Okay, and I don't know if I'm supposed to say David from the outreach team each time, but David Gerber, homeless outreach team. And I suppose you could say I'm a homeless advocate. Sometimes with our public education campaign, I've been accused of being anti-homeless, and I was hoping that I might be able to speak to this, because I am absolutely not against homeless people at all, people experiencing homelessness. I am not against that. In fact, I'm against us. I think we should do away with the term homeless people. It's not like they're from another country. Okay, so these are people experiencing homelessness. What I am against is us being complacent about homelessness. I'm anti-homelessness. We are not solving this problem. We need to not allow ourselves to remain complacent and leave kids out there on street corners fending for themselves amongst adults who've been out there for decades. So again, I'm not against homeless people experiencing homelessness, but I am opposed to homelessness in and of itself. Let's do something about it.
Ruth Daimler, I'm reading this for Wayne Martin, who was a guest today. The Supreme Court ruled 5-4 in 2010 that corporations are people and that donations are free speech. If giving and receiving political donations are granted as free speech, why should we discriminate against those suffering from poverty and from homelessness?
Well, David Gerber with the outreach team. Let me think. Real quickly, I'm just in favor of work first. I don't know if I heard the question clearly enough. Why we shouldn't discriminate against people, but if we can create some minimal expectations for people arriving in our town, then we can facilitate ways for those who would like to move up to do so without being held back by others who may not be interested in doing better for themselves. So again, I just think there should be some minimal expectations. We should ask people what type of skills they have, what kind of interests they, what type of talents they would like to participate in using. And again, I'm not really clear. I'd like to be able to think about what is the expectation when you arrive in Eugene? What do we expect of people? I'm not really clear on what that is. So I think we should have work first is really what we need. We need jobs for people, and especially young people. Young people, when they spend more than 15 nights on the street, it becomes exponentially more difficult to return to a structured life. And I like to remind guys to call home. And they tell me, look, I don't want to call home. I hate my dad. And I say, guy, why don't you give him a call and tell him how much you hate him? Keep in touch with your family. That's another key thing we can remind people of. It's dear to my heart.
Okay, great. Next question, please.
Yeah, I'm Jack Dresser. I just had a couple of comments. We have questions, I guess, attached.
Comments, please. We really need to ask the question.
One is the issue of semantics. The first thing I saw here is the word traveler. Traveler in Southern and Eastern Europe in particular means gypsies. And they're a highly derogated population in Europe. And what is a traveler except a tourist without a credit card, right? So this is discriminatory language right in the face, you know. And I like Ben's comments, you know, he's pointing out that everybody's an individual. When somebody's standing there with a need in the street, he's an individual and he has a name. He doesn't fit into a category. So this whole tendency to categorize people and then discriminate accordingly.
So could we please hear a question?
Yeah, so well, one is what are your feelings about labeling like this?
Oh, perfect.
And the other thing, I like David's idea about a campground, you know, cars, RVs, whatever, tents. You know, I suggest that the city of Eugene get
so
a KOA campground.
Can we please allow the speakers to answer the question about labeling?
Okay.
Yeah.
But what about a KOA campground also that has showers and toilets and all this and 175 campsites?
Thank you. So the question was about how do you feel about the labeling?
David Gerber with the outreach team. And the labeling, I wasn't sure if I should bring that up or not. I was trying to do my job and help people learn. So I knew that it was probably dangerous ground. I didn't feel too comfortable about it. But I thought it might be just useful into categorizing to get your head wrapped around it. And then the idea is that some people could be in all the different categories too. But labels don't really, I don't see much use in labeling people things, no.
Thank you. Thank you for the question, and thank you for the answer clarifying that. That was good. Next question.
John Annex, City Club member since 2003. The question I have relates to the effects of supply and demand. We see housing prices in Vancouver, B.C., the average price for a home is $1 million. In the state of California, the average housing price is $500,000, according to an article published last week in the paper. And it seems to me that we have the effects of this going according to the law of supply and demand are pushing people into homelessness. Do you have any ideas as to perhaps how to compensate against this trend in rising prices in the Pacific Northwest? And certainly we're feeling some of the fallout down here in Eugene. We aren't in this class of Vancouver or California yet, but we're on the way.
Okay, great. So the question was, is there any way to compensate, or can you see any way to compensate against this trend of rising housing cost?
Yeah.
Thank you, John.
You know, that's a tough one, and I think there's larger economic issues at stake there that becomes really difficult to, like, single-handedly address the rising housing costs and how that impacts everyone all the way down. I think that just to kind of try to combine the previous question around labels with this a little bit, I think that the other reason that I have a hard time with the term travelers is that we know that what you just expressed was that the housing rising housing costs are happening across the country. And that lots of people with the last recession lost their houses, putting even more demand on even like the rental level market. So you're talking about housing prices for buying a home. We're now coming into a whole generations of young people who cannot afford a home, who may not ever be able to afford a home or already have so much debt that they're not gonna be able to get a loan for whatever the housing cost is. You know, and that those folks are living on the edge, sometimes paycheck to paycheck, and become travelers on occasion when they are searching for resources. You know, and that's why, again, I was trying to like kind of point out the Grapes of Wrath as excellent reading material for the situations that we're facing right now.
Just real quickly, David Gerber with the outreach team. I will just relay my experiences from traveling in the third world country of Guatemala. I hitchhiked around in Belize and Guatemala a long time ago. And we stayed in cinder block buildings with a bathroom at the end of the hall. They have housing for people in third world countries, and it's just a couple cents per night. It's a bare bulb, a brick room, and a bathroom down the hallway. I don't know why we can't build that type of thing here. Usually they have rebar sticking out the top where they can just build on as they go, and they build them and they put people in there.
Okay, thank you. Next question.
John DeLow, City Club member. And my question is, there are people complaining about the transients, whatever, leaving a mess behind. How much is it a problem for the city or an organization to leave a garbage dumpster or a porta potty and save themselves the thousands of dollars they're claiming it costs to clean up after these people? I mean, how hard is it to do that?
I would tend to think that prevention is a lot better than having to cure later. So an ounce of prevention saves a pound of cure. And that's something that, again, back to my notion of working on an upstream way of approaching these problems, rather than waiting until people are in a making a mess, how can we keep them from getting there in the first place? But I'll just bring it back to an expectation. You know, when we sweep up the cigarette butts in Kesey Square, people are a lot less likely to throw stuff down. So when there's already a mess, people pile it on. And if we can just, we have to take this on ourselves. We certainly can't wait for these answers to fall out of the sky. And so I think that it's up to us, and we can engage people on a one-to-one basis, ask people what they're doing, how can we work with them, and especially young people, ask them what kind of work they do. And I mean, really, just plant that seed in their mind. Welcome to Eugene. What do you do?
Great. Thank you. Just briefly, we only have 2 minutes.
Okay, yeah. 30 seconds. So, and just real briefly, I think that it's interesting because, again, we're looking at an issue of can we address this ahead of time upstream? Can we create camps or places where people can be? We already know where concentrations of homeless folks are all across the city. If we created camps there that had bathrooms and garbage facilities, that would impact the kinds of messes that we're seeing downtown instantly. The other side of that is we're looking at, you know, and David's spoken to this several times about giving people work. I don't see large-scale work initiatives coming out of the city of Eugene to put people to work cleaning up those messes. And that's a real quick two birds, one stone solution. Give young people and some of these homeless youth downtown a way to make a little bit of money by helping to take care of the stuff out front. People at Whitebird, the folks that we serve, frequently clean up our area simply out of an act of gratitude for the services we provide.
That's great. Thank you. One more question.
Really quick. James Baldock, City Club member since 2012. My question is, you know, homelessness is a national problem. If we throw tons of money and have this amazing shelter and all these campgrounds, what stops us from being the mecca for homeless people and just homeless people keep coming in, overwhelming the services again? How do you stop kind of this overflow concern? Or is that even a concern?
Thank you.
I'll do it quick, and if David wants to say something to it, too. I really believe that the idea, I think what's interesting about the idea of a homeless mecca or the if you build it, they will come kind of like lines that we hear frequently from people is that as I talk to homeless advocates, homeless folks that have traveled in other cities, follow local news all across the nation, every single city says that. What does that mean if every single city says that they're concerned about having too many services because they'll become the homeless mecca, or that they have all these services and that's why they are the homeless mecca? Every single city says that.
David Gerber with the homeless outreach team, and I will just quickly say I don't profess to have all the answers, but I do think that it's important that we provide people with opportunities for themselves. And I think that we have agricultural opportunities here and that we should do our best to get people busy and not allow them to give up on themselves. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. The City Club of Eugene is very appreciative of our sponsors, including Housing and Community Services Agency, HCSAW, Hearing Associates, and KLCC 89.7 Radio. An additional thank you to KLCC for airing our programs on Monday at 6:30 following the Friday program, and to Community Television of Lane County for televising our recent City Club programs. Next week, on July 28th, we have a special treat for City Club members and guests. The program will include a State of the City Club report, followed by a short TED Talk style inspirational presentation from our very own Dan Bryant. Dan is speaking next Friday as Executive Director of Square One Villages. His talk is entitled Dreaming Big with Tiny Homes. So I expect to see all of you here for that talk next week. And that'll be followed by free desserts and refreshments. And we'll have our regular lunch meals for sale. And then more information about future programs can be found online at the City Club's website, cityclubofeugene.org. Now, our time is up. Now, let's give a big thank you to David Gerber and Ben Brubeck, our speakers. Thank you. And Aria for our first questioner. Thank you very much. And that concludes today's program.